Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and my guests today are two of my JP Morgan Asset Management colleagues, Jared Gross, Head of Institutional Portfolio Strategy, and Tina Anstett, Retirement Insights Strategist. With over 30 years of experience in the industry, Jared is responsible for providing insights and solutions to institutional clients, including corporate and public pensions, endowments, and foundations. And Tina is an attorney specializing in ERISA, the federal law that governs workplace retirement plans. She has over 30 years of retirement plan industry experience, and as JP Morgan's ERISA strategist, Tina supports our clients through the development and delivery of insights focused on the retirement plan legislative and regulatory landscape. On today's episode, we will be discussing some exciting developments around alternatives in 401ks and retirement plans. The President recently signed an executive order titled Democratizing Access to Alternative Assets for 401k Investors, and we've been getting a lot of questions about this topic. What does this order do? Who does it affect? What are the benefits and the risks of adding alternatives to retirement plans? And what could this actually look like in practice? We have a lot to talk about here, so let's get started. Let's start with introductions. Jared, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, what brought you to JP Morgan, and what you do in your role here today?
Certainly, and thank you for having me on the podcast. This is a terrific opportunity and a great topic. So I have been at JP Morgan Asset Management now for a little over 5 years, and I've been in the industry for almost 30 years. And in that time, I've worked with a variety of large institutional investors, probably more pensions and retirement-focused investors than others. But it really is a broad mix, and I think what it ultimately comes down to is helping investors make smarter choices about how they allocate their capital, and whether that's using quantitative models to really dig into how they're measuring and allocating risk and return across various asset classes, or more qualitative judgments about what's going on in the world and how we align ourselves with different trends. That is what my role is. And I think in this current moment, with DC plans on the cusp of expanding their use of alternative assets, this is a really opportune moment to have these conversations and really help educate our clients about, what the best practices are and should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you've authored a number of documents and white papers, and hopefully we'll get a chance to get into some of that in our discussion today.
Certainly hope so. Yes, thank you.
And Tina, turning to yourself, can you give us some background on your career and your role at JP Morgan Asset Management?
Sure, I'd love to. So as of today, I have been with JP Morgan for 9 months.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. But I've spent the better part of the last 30 years working with retirement plans with a focus on defined contribution plans. And it's been kind of a diverse background for me because I started working with record keepers and administrators. Then I moved more into an insurance context. I did a little bit of work with fintech. But throughout that whole time, my focus has been really to demystify ERISA, the federal law that governs retirement plans, and how the people who make decisions about the plans need to conduct themselves to stay, within ERISA's requirements, all for the protection of participants and beneficiaries, ensuring that they are able to build up tax-deferred or tax-advantaged benefits over time for a dignified retirement.
Great. Wonderful to have you here. It's certainly a large and complex space.
Indeed.
So great to have your insights on it.
Thank you.
I'd love to start with one of the biggest news stories that's hit the alternative space in a number of years, the executive order signed in August, and it was titled, let me get the title right, Democratizing Access to Alternative Assets for 401k Investors. Can you explain to our audience, what does this order do? What is it about?
Sure. I'm going to explain what it does and also what it doesn't do. Okay. What it does do, it's a directive to certain regulatory agencies, the Department of Labor, who enforces ERISA, as well as the SEC, to look at current guidance that applies to plan fiduciaries today and to really clarify what steps fiduciaries should be taking to examine alternative investments and their appropriateness for defined contribution investors. It's, you know, it's a very broad definition of alternatives, covering a number of different alternative asset classes. And what I think is important to emphasize is what it doesn't do is prescribe any particular type of investment. It doesn't tell fiduciaries that they should be putting a private equity fund in their core lineup. It's very much focused on asset allocation funds that allocate a portion to various alternative asset classes. I view it as an invitation for fiduciaries to consider whether these alternatives can benefit participants, but not a mandate to include them, because they aren't always going to be appropriate.
Okay. I like how you phrase it, an invitation to consider, but not a mandate to
Correct.
Include.
Yes.
Wonderful. And so, Jared, turning to you, you have a lot of experience in this space. Is this a completely new phenomenon? Are there retirement plans today using alternatives? Can you give us a little bit of history on kind of
yeah, absolutely.
What the space looks like today?
You know, I think you might be forgiven for thinking that this is a new phenomenon and that, you know, alternatives have been previously banned or restricted in a meaningful way. And the truth is, and I think Tina hinted at this, there's really nothing in the law that says you can't have these types of assets in a retirement plan, in a 401k plan.
Okay.
There are various reasons, you know, beyond the letter of the law, why some plan sponsors have avoided this. And, you know, we can talk about this at length maybe in a little bit. Probably first among those reasons is concern about litigation and the risk that, you know, the participants might misinterpret guidance and might be, you know, kind of allocating in the wrong way. But the reality is this has been going on for a while. So just, you know, as a very tangible example, here at JP Morgan Asset Management, we have a variety of target date retirement products, including one that contains real estate. Mm. And, you know, real estate is among the sort of broader category of alternatives that the executive order is intending to support.
Yeah.
Real estate obviously has been around a long time as an investable asset. Mm-hmm. Has a long track record. It's very well understood. And so I think, you know, it's not surprising that, you know, for those kind of legacy retirement plans that have used alternatives, real estate is a common choice. But it is also true that if you look across the broad spectrum of 401k plans, the use of alternatives is quite modest. Mm. And that's probably being generous, you know. And so there is definitely room for this to make its way into 401k allocations. And, you know, I think if done well, it could be a genuine enhancement that will be for the benefit of participants. And so I think to Tina's point, the key is really giving sponsors the roadmap to go down this path without making, you know, kind of an unnecessary, unforced error that might expose them to risk either legally in a regulatory context or in the courts.
Let's talk about some of those risks. And what are the obstacles, Tina, that have prevented greater allocations to alternatives within a retirement plan so far?
That's the burning question, right? I think, you know, one of the biggest things, if not the biggest thing, as Jared said, the risk of litigation. There has been so much class action litigation focused on 401k plans and fiduciary conduct. And, you know, it kind of misrepresents what ERISA is all about because, again, as Jared mentioned, there's no list of prohibited or approved investments for a 401k plan. It's up to the plan fiduciaries to engage in a prudent process to decide, you know, are they looking at the right things? Are they bringing in the right experts if they don't have the expertise? I mean, that's really what ERISA requires. So it's all about educating fiduciaries and providing regulatory clarity, which again, that's what the executive order is focused on, to give them the steps that they should be taking as they explore whether or not an allocation to alternatives would be appropriate.
Well, so, I would add, and I think you're better positioned maybe to go into this in detail. You know, as the courts have seen these cases, you know, some cases the sponsors have lost, in some cases the sponsors have won, and it does appear that at least recently, there have been some court rulings that are more favorable to the sponsor community and give them at least some shield when
Absolutely.
It comes to this. And that may be, you know, in addition to the executive order,
right.
a layer of protection that they can, you know, hopefully rely on.
Agreed. The case that Intel prevailed when they were called into court, they were sued for allocating to private equity and hedge funds. You know, after the financial crisis in 2008, they took a conservative position that they communicated may not perform in certain markets, but they engaged in a diligent, prudent process to make that decision and ultimately prevailed. And I think one of the most frustrating things is that it's not really that sponsors are losing, mm-hmm. they're settling because of the expense and time that litigation can take away from business operations. They're typically settling before any decision comes out. So that's why the Intel decision is a very good thing for plan sponsors, because it emphasizes that prudent process requirement and communication clearly to participants.
Yeah, and of course, nobody wants to have to go through court cases to prove that they've done the right thing. As I have an attorney, he's very fond of the phrase, litigation is a very expensive way to prove that you're right.
That's correct.
So if we can get some kind of protections and shields for managers, then that could be helpful.
And in fact, going back to the executive order, there's black and white language in there that encourages DOL to take steps that would, you know, discourage frivolous litigation.
Okay. And I wonder, one of the factors maybe that's making it possible today is the proliferation and growth of some of the newer types of alternative vehicles. So I think if you go back, you know, 10 or 15 years, when it was more drawdown fund structures, there was more complexity, liquidity challenges. Now we've got evergreen type vehicles and interval funds. So a lot more liquidity that just maybe makes the transactional element of it a little bit easier.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, again, product development is going to move toward being more DC plan friendly, to your point.
Yeah, and so just to go into this a little bit further, in terms of vehicles, Jared, you've recently written a paper on, you know, how we might see this in practice in retirement plans. And one of the vehicles that is perhaps quite well suited to retirement plans is, or to alternatives in retirement plans, is the target date fund type structure.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of a glide path structure with active management behind this. Can you touch on what is it about a target date structure that makes it particularly suitable for these types of investments?
So just to level set, the target date structure is designed to provide participants with an age-appropriate asset allocation that moves with them across time. So when they're younger, it will be biased towards higher returning assets that may have a little bit more risk. But because they have a very long horizon until they reach retirement, that risk is acceptable. And then as the time horizon between their current age and their retirement age compresses, the portfolio becomes more conservative, both more diversified and also tilted towards lower risk asset classes. So in the classic target date fund in the public markets, which is where most retirement assets are these days, that is a pivot largely from equity over time to fixed income.
Okay, so you
and that's not to say that at the end of the glide path you are in 100% bonds. These portfolios remain diversified even in the later years, but they take less risk, and that's by design. So if you think then about how the opportunity to include alternatives might influence target date sort of glide path construction, you know, first you would want to be prudent in the sizing of the overall allocation. And I think it's instructive to look at how other institutional investors have used alternatives, because they have very successfully employed alternative asset classes and private markets to generate higher returns, to produce income, and to help diversify their portfolios. But they also have to devote a lot of resources to doing it correctly and to be diligent about the manager selection. And they have constrained the size of those portfolios because of illiquidity and complexity and fees and so forth. And so, you know, when you look across different categories of institutional investor, it's not uncommon to see a weighting to alternatives or private markets somewhere between, you know, 15 and 30%. And we would think that for a target date fund, you know, something in that vicinity would be reasonable, but probably 20% is on the higher end of what's likely, at least in the initial phases of adoption. And so then the question, so you can add a sleeve of alternatives. The sort of subsidiary question is, how do you allocate across different types of alternatives within that? Mm. And, you know, our general view is that the opportunity set is quite rich and diverse, and the characteristics of individual categories lend themselves well to different phases of the life cycle, just as in the public markets. So early on in someone's working life, you would probably expect to see a higher weighting to private equity, which is less liquid but higher returning. And that's a set of characteristics that's, you know, more acceptable when you're young and have a long horizon to invest over.
And that's similar to how today in a target date fund, you might start off heavier on equities,
exactly,
less bonds.
And then over time, you'd want to introduce greater diversification, because as the balance grows, you want to protect that balance. And diversification becomes a very meaningful source of risk management. And so introducing things like private credit, like infrastructure, like real estate, these are all categories that can provide meaningful risk diversification across the broader asset allocation, not just within that 20% sleeve, but to the whole portfolio. So there's real benefits here. And then as you slide closer and closer to retirement, things that emphasize income and inflation protection will probably come to the fore. So, you know, the target date is a professionally managed, structurally diversified vehicle that participants can safely rely on to, you know, give them the returns they need without excess risk. And it's very well suited to play this role of kind of oversight of how alternative asset classes can wind up inside a 401k allocation. Mm.
That's a very helpful overview. And there's clearly a lot of variables that could be played with within the target date fund. You've got illiquidity, you've got various return characteristics, you've the income characteristics of different asset classes. So an active manager within the context of a target date fund can use these variables to.
Well, and I think you said something very important there, which is an active manager. You know, I mean, this is if you are in the public markets, there are passive investment opportunities that are viable mechanisms to gain exposure to the broader markets, whether that's passive equity, passive fixed income, and so forth. And there are, there's a very kind of rich debate around active versus passive in the public markets. In the private markets, there is no debate at all, because these are, by definition, active investments.
Everything's active.
There is no way to access private equity or private credit through a passive vehicle based on the underlying assets. You know, the benchmarks themselves are simply the aggregated performance of the managers in these sectors. You can't own that. What you have to then go out and do is find a group of managers that you think will provide acceptable performance in that sector, hopefully better than the mean, but, you know, certainly no worse than that. And that requires skill. It requires an aptitude at selecting these managers. And, you know, as the data in our paper shows, the dispersion of performance across managers is very wide. And so if you are, you know, unsuccessful and you wind up in the bottom quartile or the below median managers, your experience can be very, very different than what the median return would imply. And so I think this is one of the things that sponsors have in mind when they proceed cautiously, because they need to find a skilled partner who can handle all of this complexity and can see the full picture of the spectrum of alternative asset classes, how to distribute capital across the various categories, and then how to find managers within each who are going to do what you want them to do.
Yeah, definitely a lot to manage. So, Tina, one of the questions I'd love to explore is, we've had the executive order. It was a few months ago at this point. What has happened since that date? Have there been any developments? Are we still in the exploration phase?
There have been significant developments. So the executive order itself encouraged the DOL to rescind some less than favorable guidance that was issued a couple of years ago. They did that 4 business days after the executive order was issued.
Okay, things are moving quickly in the retirement space.
Indeed. And then a couple of weeks ago, the DOL issued an advisory opinion, not directly With respect to the asset classes we've been talking about, but with respect to lifetime income options, which again was one of the alternatives included in the executive order, and it was, you know, very helpful guidance for plan sponsors. So again, you know, as we were discussing previously, giving plan sponsors some comfort that they can rely on existing statutory guidance and regulatory guidance as well. So I think that basically what DOL is saying, that they're preparing for perhaps the issuance of some proposed regulations toward the end of the year. So that's going to be something very interesting that we'll watch for, because I think that's really the most durable type of guidance that they'll be able to be issuing.
Yeah, so possibly even before the end of 2025.
At least perhaps we'll get some Christmas time reading.
Okay.
That's usually how the DOL works.
Things are moving very quickly.
Yes, yes.
And Jared, turning back to you, and we kind of touched on this, but I'd love to explore a little bit further in terms of active management. So it may be a big leap going from today a fully passive allocation and retirement plan to the world of alternatives. Are there steps in between that retirement plan sponsors are considering?
Yeah, I think the passive target date funds are common. I think there has been a growing segment of the target date fund, sort of capital base that is what we would call hybrid, where some portion of it is passive and some portion of it is active. Mm-hmm. Often fixed income is the first place to go active. There's a very strong, kind of legacy data set suggesting that the performance of active fixed income managers is more consistently positive across time and more repeatable, which is a characteristic that makes this very appealing in the context of a long-term asset like a target date fund. I think the question is the presence of or the possibility of adding alternatives going to pull more of the asset allocation into the active space along with the alternatives? I think that's quite possible. It's not required. You know, I think at the end of the day, you know, the target date fund is kind of a safe space for a plan sponsor to introduce more of these active strategies provide elsewhere in the 401k plan on the core menu and through other, benefit provisions, access to more traditional active and passive vehicles. And so I think this is likely to be the first place that sponsors look. As it becomes more common, we may look at this from 10 years down the road and say that this was just the first step in what was an evolution of finding vehicles and providing choice to participants. But I think we also have to be, a little bit humble about this. I mean, most participants are frankly not well suited to making narrow judgments across the different types of alternative asset classes. And so having a layer of professional management to, guide them in that is, I think, quite likely to be the sort of standard of care that the industry adopts. And whether we go beyond that point is something that time will tell. But, we're not there yet. So I think let's do this one step at a time.
Yeah, and I think you'd say that for the broad alternative space, and not just the retirement space, that there's a lot of complexity out there, and an a la carte option isn't always the best option.
As I said earlier, a lot of the most sophisticated institutional investors in the world devote a tremendous amount of time and resources to getting the alternative and private market allocations right. It's not a simple thing to do well, and to land that in the lap of a participant who may be financially unsophisticated, I think would be a difficult sort of choice. And I think most sponsors are aware that that's probably not the right way to go.
Indeed. Well, wonderful having you here to talk about this topic. It's something we're getting a lot of questions about. It's a huge topic in the industry, how we expect alternatives to enter 401k plans. So really appreciate you joining me in the studio here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Jared Gross, Head of Institutional Portfolio Strategy, and Tina Anstett, Retirement Insights Strategist. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our recently released third quarter 2025 guide to alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.